All right, good morning, everybody. We still got a couple minutes left to the morning. And so you're done with your first test in here. You'll get them back in lab. So make sure you ask your lab instructor. I'm not sure that Professor Kill knows that you guys took a test last week and that they're graded and ready to view, so please remind her this afternoon. Or maybe I'll stop in lab and give her the test and you can look them over. Now, when we give Scantrons back to a student, we can't ever regrade the Scantron, right? Because it's out of our control. So if you want to go over your Scantron to get it graded properly, because maybe you put stray marks on there or something, or it wasn't a clean Scantron, or who knows what, okay? Don't get the Scantron back from your instructor. Just say, hey, I want to go over it with you, just one-on-one, and if we find a mistake, then, you know, you can correct the record. But if we give a Scantron to somebody and you disappear and come back 5 or 10 minutes later, right, we just don't ever regrade it. So the instructors will ask you if you abide by that, right, before they pass the test out to everybody. So if you don't like that procedure, then we just won't pass the test out, right? So make sure that you turn in a good, clean Scantron after a test. And if you have any questions, of course, you're welcome to see me during office hours anytime. You don't need to make an appointment. Just look in the syllabus, and you're welcome and encouraged to stop by and look over your test. And then if you have a question about a particular question on the test, you know, then we should discuss it, and so that it's a good learning experience for you. All right, so hopefully you all saw the, you know, how to study a little bit for the class and how important the exam figures are. And the exam figures actually get more important as the tests move on, right? So because you can use those as nice aids to answer a lot of questions on the test as long as you have a picture in your mind as to what's happening. All right. I had a couple of questions. So are there any other questions? Any questions for me before I just recapitulate what we talked about last time? We were in enzymes last time. Had a couple questions about enzymes. You're probably doing something about enzymes in lab or have done that already. And it was with respect to this figure right here. And there's something that's not labeled in your textbook. So let's go over this stuff. Okay. So what color does this look like to you?
Gray.
It's gray. It's just kind of a gray blob. I see it's got a couple furrows right here. We call these active sites. Why do we call these active sites? Yeah, because that's where a ligand is going to bind to the enzyme, right? So this is an enzyme. This gray blob is an enzyme. It's got to have the proper shape to bind a substrate. Another name for a small molecule that binds to a big one, whether it's an enzyme or whether it's a receptor, the small molecule sometimes is called a ligand, meaning something that binds to something that's bigger. So substrates could be considered ligands. Ligands have to have the complementary shape to the active site. So these little furrows here are the active site. They have to have the proper shape in order to bind these substrates. All right, and then after the substrates bind, what do you get? It's labeled. This is an easy one to see. That's just the enzyme substrate complex. And that just allows these two substrate molecules to come into contact with each other in the proper way so that a reaction can take place, instead of the millions of other ways that these two molecules can bump into each other that won't produce a reaction. All right? And then the new products are released, and then you end up with this thing right here. All right? And the question that I've received a number of times is, what the heck is this thing right here? Well, yeah, what color is it? Yeah, what color was the enzyme? Is there a change in color? The color is the same. And I see I got a bunch of bumps all over here. Do I have a bunch of bumps all over here? Yeah. And what about these furrows right here and right here? Do they look the same? Okay. What about the overall shape of the enzyme compared to this molecule over here? Does it look the same? Yeah, it looks the same to me. Does anybody see a difference right there? All right, so I guess the question is, what's the difference between this thing that's called an enzyme and this thing over here? There's no difference at all, right? There's absolutely no difference. So an enzyme does not get changed or used up or anything like that during a chemical reaction, right? So it's able to do what? It's able to catalyze this reaction over and over and over and over again because it doesn't get used up. And that's true of any kind of catalyst, any kind of chemical catalyst. This one we call a biological catalyst because what's the nature of this molecule right here? Is it a nucleic acid? Is it a lipid? Is it a polysaccharide? Or what the heck is it? It's a protein, right? It's just made out of amino acids, right? So here's a protein. So biological catalysts, most of them are proteins, right? And they don't get used up during a reaction either. Okay. So the enzyme is what? Unaltered. That's what we say about that. So yeah, you would have to label this thing enzyme. But now you can change the shape of this thing. How would you change the shape of this enzyme right here? What could you do? You could heat it up, right? You could cook it, for instance, and then you would denature it. You'd drastically change the shape. And if you denature this enzyme, will you ever be able to get it back into this conformation? No, because it's irreversible, right? So, all right. So, and you can change the shape a little bit by changing the salt concentration or the pH of the solution that it's in. And as a matter of fact, if you change the salt concentration drastically or the pH drastically, you can denature this protein just as well as if you were to heat it, right? You can cook foods with acids or with salt, right? And that preserves the food as well.
Yeah. Something,
yeah.
With acids, for example.
Okay.
Does it change the function? It changes the shape. Does it change the function?
Okay, that's a pretty good question. If you change the shape of this enzyme, irregardless of what method you use, whether it's pH or temperature or salt concentration, do you change the function? And the answer that should just be radiating from you is yes, because there's always a structure-function relationship. Because if you change the shape, you change the active sites. And if the active sites change, then it can't bind the substrate. And if the substrates can't bind, you don't get the enzyme-substrate complex, right? And that is what's going to prevent the production of the products right here. So yeah, you change the shape of something, the function just automatically changes. You change it a little bit, the function changes a little bit. You change the shape a lot, the function changes a lot. Okay? Yeah? It's easy to change the shape of these proteins right here because a lot of bonds go into making this conformation, and some of the bonds are hydrogen bonds, which are weak. They're easy to break. And some of the bonds are even weaker. They're van der Waals forces, right? And so by slight changes in temperature and pH, you can really change the shape of that particular molecule. Now, what is more difficult to change is the primary sequence of a protein, because then you actually have to break covalent bonds. That's difficult to do, okay? And then you need really harsh conditions, like conditions in the stomach, which are very acidic, or conditions in the small intestine, which are extremely alkaline. You can break peptide bonds via digestion, but that's a pretty radical process, yeah, to break those covalent bonds. Okay, so we also talked about some names of enzymes that you should know. Definitely you should know that most words, when they have an ASE on the end of them, right, the suffix, that means that it's going to catalyze a reaction, it's going to be an enzyme. And then some names of enzymes you should know, like a phosphatase always takes a phosphate group off of a big molecule. A kinase enzyme always adds a phosphate to a large biochemical. All right, so the ones, actually you should probably just be familiar with all these. Catalase breaks down hydrogen peroxide. We talked about that last time, remember? Hydrogen peroxide will automatically break down by itself into water and oxygen. If you let it sit around for a number of decades, it will just automatically break down. And if you shine light on it, it will break down faster. But if you have this enzyme catalase, how quick will it break down? Well, within seconds, right? And you can actually observe it. When you cut yourself and put hydrogen peroxide on that wound, it's just going to bubble that oxygen right up and help clean the wound out. Okay. All right, and then we talked about the optimum. Different enzymes have different optimal pHs. And again, that's because what are you doing to the shape of the enzyme as you change the pH? Like for pepsin, when you change the pH from 0 to 2, what are you doing to the enzyme? You're tweaking the shape, right? And when it gets to pH 2, it has just a proper shape of the active site so that it can bind the substrate and the enzyme substrate complex can form, and then that's going to produce products. And then as you move away from pH 2 up to neutral, then the shape of the enzyme changes and its activity changes. Now, what would you invoke to explain why enzyme activity changes for pepsin when you move from pH 2 to pH 6? Because the pH is changing, but what's really happening there? Yeah, it's going from an acid condition to a more basic condition. But what picture should you have in your mind? The pH is definitely changing. It's going from acid to more basic. But what's happening to the enzyme? Okay. Well, at pH 2, okay, maybe it looked like this, right? It's ready to grab substrates. And then as the pH changes, what happens? The shape changes. Okay, and as the shape changes, what happens to the activity? It decreases too. Okay? So think of when you change the pH, you're changing the shape of the enzyme and its activity is going to change as well. Okay. All right, so we want to talk about, since enzymes catalyze reactions, they control metabolism inside your body. They control what reactions are going to take place and which are not going to take place. And so controlling enzymes is very important for biological systems. And there are a number of ways that enzymes can be controlled. There are things called cofactors and coenzymes that help enzymatic activity. Right? And they are necessary for many enzymes. A cofactor is a small metal ion that has to be around in solution, like calcium. Magnesium is very important for some chemical reactions. Manganese, copper, and zinc, and even a little bit of selenium. You need just very, very small trace amounts of these factors in your body. These are what we call cofactors. They're just metal cations that will allow an enzyme reaction to proceed. As opposed to a coenzyme, all right, when we talked about enzymes, what is the basic nature, the fundamental nature of an enzyme in your body? Okay, yeah. It catalyzes reactions, but I'm wondering, you know, how would you build an enzyme? What building block do you need? Yeah, you need amino acids because enzymes are proteins, right? So they're big biochemicals. So whenever you see that term enzyme, you should automatically be thinking about what? Big biological molecule. Now, is calcium, magnesium, manganese, are these big biological molecules with a lot of carbon atoms and a lot of nitrogen atoms and hydroxyl groups and carbonyl groups and stuff like that? No, they're just a single atom. All right, but a coenzyme is what? A huge biochemical. It's a big, big molecule. Right? And they're derived from vitamins. And what a coenzyme does is that it transports products of a reaction from one enzymatic pathway to another. So it's like a carrier molecule. It's like a taxi molecule. And as a matter of fact, you could even think of a transfer RNA as like being a coenzyme, right? Because a transfer RNA is a big biological molecule, and it just carries something from one place in the cell to another so that chemical reactions can proceed. So what does a transfer RNA carry from one place in the cell to another? A tRNA, what does it carry around inside the cell? Yeah, a nucleotide. Right, so it carries, it carries amino acid. Yeah, an amino acid from some place in the cytoplasm to a ribosome so that translation can take place. So you should think of a tRNA as a coenzyme, not a cofactor, because cofactors are really, really small. All right, so how is it that cofactors can aid in enzymatic activity? Well, cofactors can bind to a couple different places on an enzyme. So here we have an enzyme, and you can see, what are these little dimples here? How would you label these little dimples? Those would be the active sites. And they have to have a complementary shape compared to the substrates, right? Because they're going to bind substrates. And in this position right here, the shape of the active site, it is not proper to bind these two substrates. But once a cofactor binds to the enzyme at a site other than the active site, now the active site, look at the active site. See how it's changed? It matches up more properly with the substrate, so this enzyme right here will have only the proper shaped active site if a cofactor is bound to it. All right, and that could be, give me an example of a cofactor. Calcium, magnesium, something like that. These are big, bulky elements, and when they bind to a protein, guess what they do? They change the shape, right? It's like poking a finger in your side. It's going to change the shape of that enzyme, so now the active site has a more proper shape. It can bind substrate. So what do we call this moiety right here? This is the enzyme substrate complex, and that allows the products to form. Okay, here's another example of a cofactor where it binds actually within the active site, right? So this is another location where a cofactor can bind, and then it allows the active site to gain the proper conformation so that the enzyme substrate complex can form and then the reaction can proceed. And without this cofactor, enzyme activity is greatly reduced. All right, so we certainly need magnesium and manganese and selenium and all these things in our diet to allow important biochemical reactions to proceed. Okay, many enzymes are produced in an inactive form. And you think that's a good thing?
Yes.
Okay, why do you think that's a good thing? Yeah, because for instance, if you make digestive enzymes, the pancreas is responsible for making digestive enzymes, and if the pancreas produced them in an active form, what would happen to the pancreas? It would be digested away. And that's kind of important today, because who died yesterday? Yeah, Patrick Swayze, and he had pancreatic cancer, really terrible kind of disease. Amazing that he lived quite so long. So somebody must be making tremendous progress on how to treat that disease process. But one of the problems with that is that when the pancreas becomes disturbed, it starts to digest itself. It's really difficult to treat. Okay, so in the normal circumstance, digestive enzymes from the pancreas are secreted via the pancreatic duct into the small intestine, where they become activated, and there they do their work because the small intestine can protect itself when it's normal and healthy from digestion. Okay. All right, so how are some enzymes activated? They can be activated a number of different ways. We saw how cofactors can adjust the activity of enzymes. But many are activated by the addition of a phosphate group. We call that phosphorylation or dephosphorylation. So what kind of enzyme would phosphorylate an enzyme to turn it on, to turn a switch to make that enzyme work? What would that be? What would be the name of an enzyme that can add a phosphate to something else? That is a kinase. That's a kinase. And if some enzymes, on the other hand, have to be dephosphorylated to become activated, what kind of enzyme is going to dephosphorylate an enzyme? A phosphatase, right? And so these two processes, phosphorylation and dephosphorylation, can be like used as a light switch to turn lights on and off, right? So using that metaphorically, or turn an enzyme activity on and off. So these are very important. Others can be activated by ligands, like cofactors, some small molecules, and maybe even some second messengers. All right, and second messengers are produced inside the cell when a first messenger binds to a receptor on the plasma membrane. Okay, this slide right here you might sort of be familiar with already. This here is a plot of reaction rate versus substrate concentration, and it kind of reminds me a little bit about membrane transport, and I think that was even one of the questions on the test. What were some characteristics of enzyme transport? Okay, they're very specific. Okay, that means that what, the shape of the molecule being transported has to bind to the active site of the transporter, and as the shape of the of that molecule changes, it won't bind to the transporter and therefore it couldn't get through the membrane. So the same thing with enzymes, right? The ligand has to have the right shape to bind to the active site. And If we don't change the concentration of the enzyme and increase the concentration of the substrate, what happens to the reaction rate? It increases, right? And then it kind of levels off. And at this point, where if we increase the substrate concentration even further, the reaction rate won't change. This is what? The maximum rate. And that occurs when the enzyme is completely saturated. Right, so at this point in time, as soon as reactants disassociate from the enzyme substrate complex, more products bind to it immediately, right? Then if we add more reactants to the mixture, you don't get any more enzyme substrate complex form because it's already all used up. All the active sites are already bound up, and that's what produces saturation. All right, so if your body wants to increase the reaction rate of that catalyzed reaction further, what does it need to do? If all the enzymes are saturated, what do you need to do? I think somebody said had a good idea. You have to build or activate more enzymes, right? You have to actually synthesize more enzymes, and then more substrate can bind to those additional enzymes. Okay, some enzymes are reversible, or some catalyzed reactions are reversible, okay? So both the forward and backward reactions are catalyzed by the same reaction, and let's take a look at this reaction that we have right here. We've got H2O, what's that? And what's CO2? Carbon dioxide. These two substrates can combine to form this compound over here. Does anybody know what this one is called? This is carbonic acid. And what does an acid do? How do I know this is an acid? What does it do? What's the definition of an acid? It donates something. What does it donate? It donates a proton to a solution, a water solution. So carbonic acid can dissociate into a hydrogen atom and what? An HCO3 with a minus sign right here, and that's called bicarbonate. All right, but let's just look at this reaction. And notice, what can you tell me about this arrow right here? It can go both ways, right? It is reversible. So it doesn't require much energy to do this. All right, so water and carbon dioxide can make carbonic acid. Carbonic acid can make CO2 and water. And the way that this reaction proceeds is based on the concentration of these chemicals. So that if we put a lot of CO2 in solution, the primary way this reaction is going to move, think of it sort of like diffusion. How does diffusion go? From high concentration to low concentration. So if we increase the concentration of CO2, it's going to force the reaction to the right. Right? Or if we increase the concentration of carbonic acid, the reaction is going to automatically shift to the left, right? That's going to produce water and carbon dioxide. Another way of thinking of it, if we have this chemical system and we take a lot of water out of it, if we dehydrate it, what's going to happen to this reaction? It's going to shift it to the left to replenish the water molecules that we take out of it, right? So if we dump water in, it's going to force it to the right. If we take water out, it's going to force it to the left. And the same for each one of these different chemical compounds. We call that the law of mass action. So that's another way that your body can regulate chemical reactions in your body by removing certain chemicals, and that's going to force a reaction to go one way or the other. This is going to be a really important chemical reaction when we get to the respiratory chapter, because what's an important chemical of respiration? What is your body producing all the time? CO2, right? Okay. And the other thing that you should know from this slide is, what is the name of the enzyme that makes this reaction happen like that? There's an enzyme. This reaction will happen fairly quickly, but there is an enzyme that will make it happen extremely fast, just lightning fast. And that is, it's on the slide right here, it is what? Carbonic anhydrase. Carbonic anhydrase. All right, so you want to know that. All right, so there's another name for the law of mass action that some of you might be aware of. What's another name for describing how this chemical reaction can adjust and shift depending on whether you change the concentration of one of the products or reactants. What's that called? Somebody probably knows, but it's really difficult to pronounce. So I was hoping somebody would pronounce it for me. No? Okay. The law of mass action is called Le Chatelier's principle. Does that ring a bell? Le Chatelier's principle? Well, you might want to know how to spell that. I can't get to it easily, but sort of easily. Here it is, Le Chatelier's principle. All right, so you can copy that down and look it up on Google or Wikipedia or something and become a little bit familiar with the law of mass action. All right, so let's get back to our show. And I'll get my pointer back. All right, so now let's talk about some other general properties of metabolic reactions. All right, so a metabolic pathway is a sequence of enzymatic catalyzed reactions that begin with some initial substrate, like A, and then progress through a number of enzyme catalyzed reactions, and they end up in a final product. All right, so A finally is going to be converted into product F, but it's got to first be converted into B, and then enzyme number 2 converts it into C, enzyme 3 converts it into D, and then even another enzyme converts it into E, and then the final enzymatic reaction turns it into a final product. So this is what we call a metabolic pathway. And we're going to look at a number of really important metabolic pathways in your body. And these different steps, or the products of the different steps, are what we call intermediates, metabolic intermediates. All right, so this is just a definition of an enzymatic pathway. And they are regulated. One of the ways that they are regulated, all right, I guess maybe I'll go back to this one, say that in your body you have no final product F, and your body needs some final product F. So what would be a good thing to do is to activate this metabolic pathway so that the substrate that you have in your body can be converted into product F. All right. So this metabolic pathway gets activated, and then the final product builds up in your body, right, and it reaches the set point. Now what would be a good thing for your body to do? Yeah, to turn it off, right? Because you don't need more F than what you need, obviously, right? So turn this metabolic pathway off. And this is how your body can accomplish it. It's through something called end product inhibition. All right, so here we have a metabolic pathway. It's got an interesting little complication because we see a branch point. Right? But in any case, you have substrates A eventually coming into the final product F, right? Okay, so let's say your body needs a lot of this, which we call F prime, right? You see the F prime is a little bit different than F right here. And there is a branch point in this metabolic pathway at step C, right, where C gets converted into D, or it can be converted into D prime. Well, when your body needs F prime, right, enzyme C is activated. I'm sorry, enzyme this 3 prime becomes activated, and C gets diverted into the lower pathway, building up a concentration of F prime. And then F prime goes back, and it can bind to enzyme 3 prime. And when it binds, guess what it does? It decreases the activity, changes the active site of that enzyme. So now B, or I guess C, is building up inside the cell. So what does that do to Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action? It's going to force the production of more intermediates in this upper pathway. All right. So at a branch point, this final product can alter what product is going to be made as a result of that. Yeah. Yeah, so this is a really good example of negative feedback.
Does that negative feedback often go to
D and D prime? Usually it's only at a branch point. Okay, which
is... Like
yeah.
Okay, I got
Yeah, so it's usually at a branch point. You know, you're going to find where it can operate in the middle of a metabolic pathway under certain catalyzed reactions, but more frequently it's going to be at some kind of branch point so that you don't have buildup of any of these other intermediates inside the cell. Because if you have a buildup of product B, right, then that's going to inhibit the formation of A. Okay, so it's usually at a branch point. And when a final product interacts with a branch point to adjust enzymatic activity, we call that allosteric inhibition, right? And that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. And what does a negative feedback mechanism maintain? Homeostasis, right? All right, so, and as the concentration of F prime decreases, what happens? Then enzyme 3 prime turns back on and then it fills up the proper level of F prime over here. Right, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining the proper concentration of F prime in your body. Yeah. It could be either way. Usually it would be at a different site on the enzyme. Okay. And let's see, I don't think I'll talk about this one, a real life situation. Okay. Okay, so we're going to move on to bioenergetics. So I'm not going to ask you about any of these different disease processes, so you don't have to memorize these disease processes for a test, for instance. Are there any in particular? Maybe during later parts of the class I'll talk about some of those. Okay, so bioenergetics, it has to do with energy in what? In biology, in some kind of biological system. All right, so it refers to energy flow in living systems, and we've got a couple laws of thermodynamics, and thermodynamics is just the study of energy flow, how energy moves around within our universe. Okay, but before we talk about energy flow, I guess you should have a little bit of an understanding of what energy is. It's a very nebulous term, right? We can't really, it's really hard to put our finger on it because it's not like a pencil or something. So, I don't know. What is energy? Maybe I said before earlier in class what energy is, but what's one way to think of energy? Is it a good thing, bad thing, or what? Okay, energy is something that a system has to have in order to do work. All right, so energy allows a system to do work. So when you have a lot of energy, what can you do? You can do a lot of work. And on days when you have very little energy, I'm using this metaphorically, then what? You just can't do very much work because you don't have a lot of energy. Okay, so energy allows different systems to do work. All right, like your car does work when it carries you up a hill. What does it need to do that? It needs energy, right, in the form of gasoline, for instance. All right, so that takes us to the first law of thermodynamics. It states that energy can be transformed from one kind of energy to another, but can't be created or destroyed. So the amount of energy in our universe is constant. It's never changing, but it flows from one thing into another thing. All right, so what are some different forms that energy can take? So what chemical energy, what's probably your favorite chemical energy molecule? Okay, ATP, really good. Okay, I was going to say gasoline. Okay, that's not a biological molecule, but ATP is really good. Another biochemical that's real important in terms of energy is glucose, right? And lipids are a storage form of energy, storage form of chemical energy, right? And what can you, so ATP is a form of chemical energy. What can you do, what kind of mechanical energy can ATP be converted into? So energy can be converted from one form to another. You got ATP, what can you do in your body that's mechanical, that needs energy in order to work? Muscle. Yeah, whenever you lift a weight, whenever you contract a muscle, right, that's mechanical energy. And the energy for muscle contraction comes from ATP, which is chemical energy. So that kind of describes the first law of thermodynamics that says, what, you have chemical energy, it can be converted into mechanical energy, right? But you got to have the right kind of mechanism there. In a car, you can take chemical energy in the form of gasoline and convert it into pistons going up and down. What kind of energy is that? That's mechanical energy, right? So energy can be converted from one form to another. And as a matter of fact, light that's coming out of light bulbs, that's very interesting because it takes energy for a light bulb to emit light. What kind of energy does a light bulb need? What kind of energy does a light bulb need to make light? Okay. Because light is almost like pure energy, it needs electricity. It needs electrons to flow from what? High concentration to low concentration. What do we call that difference in electrical charge? What do we call that difference in electrical charge? Whether it's across the cell membrane or across the terminals of a light bulb, that's a potential or a voltage, right? That's just an electrical voltage. So electrons flow through the wire, and as they flow through, it releases energy and the light bulb emits light. All right, so light is a form of energy. A light bulb converts electrical energy into light energy. And then probably one of the most interesting systems on our planet is that there is a system that can take light energy and put it into chemical energy. And that would be a good example of photosynthesis. And who can do photosynthesis? Plants, basically. They need special pigments that can absorb light. Remember, a pigment from anatomy is just a chemical compound that can absorb light, which means what? It absorbs energy. And plants have figured out a way to take that energy and trap it in chemical compounds that can actually make glucose. So I'm very envious of plants, right? They can make glucose all day long. That'd be like going to the beach, right, and laying out in the sun and drinking a milkshake all day long. That's what a plant can do, okay? We can't do that. All right, so that's the first law. Energy can be interconverted, but it can't be created or destroyed. And so you can convert mechanical energy into chemical energy or chemical into mechanical, one way or the other. It really doesn't matter. All right, the second law states that energy flows, or these energy transformations, all right, can only flow if there is an increase in entropy or randomness. It's the degree of disorganization of a system. All right, so energy will flow from a highly organized state into what? A less organized state or a more disorganized state. All right, so now, what do you think about yourself? Are you a highly organized state or highly unorganized? And you know what? You're amazingly organized. All right, and so you might be wondering, well, how is it that I can stay alive? Okay, if I'm so highly organized, but things only happen automatically if things go to a more disorganized state, right? So biology kind of interrupts this second law, but what we're going to see is that biology has an input of energy, and it even produces more disorganization outside of itself to maintain, right, a very high entropic state internally. All right, so only free energy, which is energy in an organized state, can be used to do work. So something that is highly organized can do a lot of work. Oh, and what did I just call you guys? Oh, this is bad. You really were happy when I said you're highly organized. But what does that mean you're able to do? That means you're able to do a lot of work, okay, because you're highly organized. Okay. All right, so systems tend to go from states of higher free energy to states of lower free energy. That's the way things go. All right. All right, so the second law dictates that all living organisms require continual input of energy, and plants obtain this energy from sunlight. All right, they can, because plants have pigments. What color are most plants? Yeah, they're mostly green. There's all different kinds of pigments in plants, but guess what chloral means? It means green. Chlorophyll is the kind of pigment that plants have that can absorb light. And when a plant absorbs light, it can take molecules like carbon dioxide and water that are in a highly disorganized state, right? Very disorganized right here, and it can put them together into a very organized state. Right? But these carbon dioxide and water won't automatically make glucose. That is thermodynamically impossible. In order for this process to happen, in order for a plant to make glucose from carbon dioxide and water, what does it need? It needs energy. Okay, it needs to absorb energy from the sun. Right, so a plant takes energy and light and converts it into chemical energy that is in the covalent bonds of a glucose molecule. And in so doing, it produces oxygen. And as a matter of fact, what do we call this process right here? What do we call this process? Oh, you got to take a biology class. That's what we call photosynthesis, right? Photo, because it's using light. Synthesis, because it's making glucose, a high-energy compound. And we're going to see how many ATPs our body can make from every glucose. For instance, when we eat a plant or glucose that's made by a plant. Okay, what was I going to say? Well, I don't have a sign-in sheet. So if somebody has a blank piece of paper, maybe put Bio-241 and start passing it around. You started in the back? I tell you what, we'll take two. I got one here in the front and one in the back, and pass them both down to the front. Okay, and I'll just staple them together. So put the date, which is September 15th. Okay, September 15th. All right, so what we have here, oh, I know what I wanted to say. All right, so what we have right here is a nice diagram that shows what? Free energy, right? So as these molecules move up this axis, their free energy increases, right? Their entropy actually, the entropy actually decreases as it moves up this axis right here. All right, the one thing I wanted to say is has more to do with biology than physiology, but what do plants need besides sunlight in order to make glucose?
Water.
They need water. And what else? Yeah, they need carbon dioxide. And what have you been learning lately? How bad carbon dioxide is, right? Okay. And, well, you know what? You know what limits photosynthesis? Is photosynthesis a good process on the planet or a bad process? Well, it's a good process. It drives all living processes on the planet. And you know what rate limits photosynthesis? It is carbon dioxide concentration. Okay, so you need to think about how important carbon dioxide is and whether the planet should have carbon dioxide or not. It should, because that's what drives photosynthesis. Right, and without photosynthesis, there would be no milkshakes for anybody to drink, right? Okay. All right, so we got glucose right now. C6H12O6, it's what, a carbohydrate? For every carbon, there is what, an H2O molecule? That's how it got its name. And there is a lot of free energy in glucose. And so what can animals do? Animals can use the chemical energy that's in glucose, right, and convert it into other kinds of energy, like what? Mechanical energy, okay, or producing electrical gradients across the cell. What can produce electrical gradient across a cell? A potential, a membrane potential. What's one thing that's really important for producing a membrane potential? You've got the sodium potassium ATP pump, right? You got the ATP pump that needs what? ATP in order to pump sodium and potassium, producing an electrical potential across the cell. All right, so I want to give you the concept of an endergonic versus exergonic reaction, and maybe you've covered this in lab. I'm not sure, okay? But a really nice, simple way of remembering this is, let's take an important energy molecule, and somebody said this is their favorite one, and I can't disagree. Okay, that's a really important energy molecule. This thing can be broken down into ADP plus inorganic phosphate, right? Remember, that's a little bit more complicated than just P. That's P sub I. There's oxygens on it and a couple hydrogens and things like that. All right, but so this is the hydrolysis of ATP. I'm not going to draw the water molecule, but there's something here, right, that I've left off this chemical reaction that's really important. Okay, it's that nebulous thing that allows work to take place. What allows work? It is energy. So where should I put energy in this chemical reaction? All right, and notice I have it going from left to right. And where should energy go? It should go over here on the right-hand side of the equation. I'm not going to tell you how much energy it is, but you should imagine it's what? It's a lot, right? A lot of energy. So, as we have the chemical reaction written in this direction, is it an exergonic or endergonic reaction? If energy is on the right-hand side, it is exergonic. So, I'll say exergonic. All right, so this happens quite readily. So because this is a highly ordered chemical, there's more randomness when we have ATP and inorganic phosphate, so this readily happens. Now, what about if we draw the chemical reaction going to the left? Right? That can happen, but in order to take ADP and inorganic phosphate and put them together with a dehydration synthesis type of reaction, what else do we need? We need energy, all right? And so what would this reaction be called? That would be endergonic. Yeah, an endergonic reaction. All right, so the hydrolysis of ATP, is exergonic. All right, so where do we have a lot of energy? We have a lot of energy in glucose, and who do we have to thank for that? Plants, right? Okay. And in order for our bodies to get that chemical energy out, there has to be oxygen available. And then here is something where glucose is converted into a bunch of intermediate steps, and it finally ends up as CO2 and water. All right, so what do we call this staircase right here that's producing a lot of intermediates? What is this thing called? That was in right here. That's a metabolic pathway. Okay, that's a metabolic pathway where we have all of these different intermediates. All right, and as glucose is converted into the first intermediate, what happens to its free energy? It decreases, right? So glucose, and since it's decreasing, energy is released. So what kind of step is this? Glucose going to this first intermediate. Is it an endergonic or an exergonic reaction? It's releasing energy. That's the bottom arrow. That's an exergonic reaction. And then it gets converted into another intermediate, which is even at a lower energy. That's another exergonic reaction. So you can see we have a series of exergonic reactions, finally producing CO2 and water. And this energy, cells have figured out a way to get this energy and make what out of it? Make ATP, which is the energy currency that's in our cells that's used to do work. Okay, and we're going to look and see how cells utilize and harness this energy when glucose is converted into CO2 and water. We call that combustion, right? And you can do that at home. How would you take glucose and convert it into CO2 and water at home, or maybe not completely, maybe some intermediate over here that's kind of maybe charcoal-y or brown? I'm thinking like in the kitchen. Like creme brulee, has anybody ever done that? Put sugar on top of some pudding and then take a torch and kind of burn the sugar a little bit, right, and make it kind of crusty, and that's a dessert. You don't believe me. Try it sometime. You'll like it. Okay. All right, so don't forget the definition for endergonic versus exergonic reactions. All right, so cells require input of free energy. Like in what form? What form do most cells, animal cells, what do they need? They need glucose, right? They need sugar, right? And maybe some cells are a little bit more sophisticated. They can convert various compounds into sugar and get the energy out of it, right? If you're a plant cell, light will suffice, but since we're animals, we're thinking about animal cells. Okay, so they do this by coupling endergonic reactions to exergonic reactions. What does that mean? Let's look at this one right here. So glucose going to CO2 and water, is this exergonic or endergonic? That's exergonic. And what cells do, it couples this reaction, which is highly exergonic, to the production of ATP. And what is the production of ATP called? That's an endergonic reaction. All right, so cells have to couple exergonic reactions like this one right here with the production of ATP, which is an endergonic reaction. And we're going to look and see how that happens in the next chapter. But here is a little illustration, right, that maybe helps describe how it happens. We have a couple gears right here, and we have a vertical axis where we have a plot of free energy. So remember, things can do work when they go from high free energy to low free energy, right? And here we have a wheel that's going to turn. When reactants turn into products, they're going to lose energy, right? They're going to lose free energy. What kind of reaction, right, as it proceeds, releases energy, goes from high free energy to low free energy? What kind of reaction is that? That's an exergonic reaction, right? And what cells do is that they couple another metabolic pathway where reactants are converted into products, but look at the free energy. It goes from low free energy to high free energy in this particular case. All right, so this big wheel right here is most of the chemical reactions in your body that we're going to look at, like glycolysis and electron transport chain, which are highly exergonic reactions. They're coupled to other chemical processes in the body that take ADP and inorganic phosphate and make what out of it? ATP. All right, so what do we call ADP plus inorganic phosphate being turned into ATP? What kind of reaction is that? That's an endergonic reaction. Is that what I wrote on the board? Well, I hope so. Okay. So maybe you should change your notes just a little bit. Okay, so in your notes, there's a statement, an exergonic reaction breaks down ATP. Well, you know what? The breakdown of ATP is what? Is an exergonic reaction, right? All right, and how does that happen? How does your body make ATP? Because there has to be this metabolic pathway, which is highly exergonic, to make ATP. So most exergonic reactions in the body make ATP. And we're going to look at these chemical reactions right here. The first one we're going to look at is glycolysis. Okay. All right, so here is a nice slide that actually shows what an ATP molecule looks like. ADP has just two phosphate groups, like one here. This would be the alpha. Here would be the beta. This is the last one. We call that the gamma phosphate. And inorganic phosphate is just a PO4 group right here. And what does this solid line here represent between a phosphate and this oxygen? Okay, that's a bond. Ooh, what kind of bond? That's a nice covalent bond, which is kind of a high energy bond. It's a strong bond. And I also see another thing right here. Here's a squiggle instead of a straight line. It's not dashed. It's still a straight line, but it's a squiggle. Guess what that means? That bond is covalent, but it's even a much higher energy bond than the usual kind of covalent bonds that we see between carbon atoms, right, and other elements. So this is what we call a high energy phosphate bond. Yeah.
Can you go back to the other slide?
Yeah. Let's see. Yeah, I wanted to say one last thing. How many high energy bonds do you see in ATP? There are actually two. Right, ADP has a high energy bond. This one, though, is not quite as high of energy as this one right here, but nonetheless, there are two high energy bonds, and this third one over here is not high energy at all. So adenosine monophosphate is not really considered a high energy molecule because it doesn't have that high energy bond right there. So when you break this bond, what happens? That energy is released, and your body learns how to trap that energy to do what? Muscle contraction. To make a voltage across the cell, right, that powers your living systems in your body. Okay, this one right here. Yeah.
Okay, it says that the breakdown of ATP is exergonic, and then it says exergonic reactions make ATP.
Exergonic reactions? Yes.
A breakdown and an
exergonic? Okay. All right. Okay. ATP, when it's broken down to ADP and inorganic phosphate, plus energy, by definition, that has to be an exergonic reaction. All right. Now, if you go the reverse way, just think about ATP and ADP. If you go the reverse, ADP plus inorganic phosphate, to make ATP out of it, what else do you need? You need energy. So by definition, if you go the opposite way, that's what? An endergonic reaction. Okay. But what reactions drive this right here? There has to be some other chemical reactions that are coupled to it that do what? That release this energy. And what kind of chemical reaction releases energy? Exergonic. Right? So in order to make ATP, there has to be some metabolic pathway that's highly exergonic to make it. So, let's take a look at this thing right here. Which one are you looking at? This one right here?
Yeah.
Most exergonic reactions in the body make ATP. Right? So, this small wheel right here, all right, reactants like ADP and inorganic phosphate going to ATP, that is endergonic. And in order to make ATP, how can you drive this little wheel? Okay, in this direction. You have to have another set of chemical reactions that are what? Highly exergonic. As a matter of fact, even have more energy to give up. All right, so this is true. Most exergonic reactions in the body make ATP. And that energy ends up in ATP, and then your body uses the energy in ATP to do what? Other kinds of work, because in order to do work, you have to have energy, and it comes from the breakdown of ATP. All right, so it's a little bit of a mind twister, all right, but you might want to just start out by writing this equation down and maybe even labeling these wheels right here. All right, so for instance, ADP and inorganic phosphate right over here making what? ATP. That would be an endergonic reaction. And the other exergonic reactions, all right, let's just label this big blue wheel. Let's just say that this is glycolysis. Put glycolysis right there. And we're going to look at glycolysis almost the very next item. Yeah, I see another question. Oh, you got to speak way, way up. Oh, I just can't hear you. Oh, the PI stands for inorganic phosphate, which is this thing right here, inorganic phosphate. It's P sub I, and inorganic phosphate, okay, is this thing. That's inorganic phosphate, and when you put that in water, it can dissociate a little bit. Okay, and what do you, and you're left with this proton in solution. So what is a compound that can actually donate protons to solution? What's that called? That's an acid. Yeah. So inorganic phosphate is really a form of phosphoric acid. Okay. Okay. All right. So here is ATP. Ooh, oxidation reduction reactions. Ah, I forgot that was in here. Okay. All right. Let's see what I can say about oxidation reduction reactions. All right, so we have a proton right here. It has a positive charge. And there are things like electrons, right? What kind of charge does an electron have? A negative charge, right? And they can, electrons can move from one molecule to another. And if a molecule gains an electron, we say it becomes reduced, right? And in order to become reduced, that electron has to come from someplace, right? It's got to come from another molecule. And when that molecule donates an electron, it loses it, we say that it becomes oxidized. So oxidation and reduction always work together, right? One molecule can't be reduced unless what happens? Another molecule becomes oxidized. And so we call that an oxidation-reduction reaction. One really can't happen with the other. We can't just create an electron someplace and give it to somebody, right? We got to get it from one pocket and put it in the other pocket. All right. So a reducing agent is something that donates electrons, right? A reducing agent is something that can give electrons away. But when I give an electron away, what happens to me? I become oxidized. All right, so you really got to think about that a little bit. An oxidizing agent is something that will accept electrons. And when I accept electrons from you guys, what happens to me? I become reduced, right? When I accept electrons, I become reduced. All right, so reduction and oxidation reactions are always coupled reactions. And actually what I want you to remember, I don't like this right here, they often involve transfer of protons, but I actually want you to think of the transfer of electrons, because that's the basic definition. So you could just cross this off right here. All right, and I'll show you the best ways to think about that in terms of the reactions we're going to be looking at. All right, so coenzymes play important roles as, instead of proton carriers, what do you want to say right here? Electron carriers. Actually put electrons right here. All right, and here are two of the coenzymes that we're concerned with, and that is NAD and FAD. And you won't have to know what they stand for, but I'll just tell you, that's nicotinamide dinucleotide. All right, what's a nucleotide? A basic building block of? Yeah, like nucleic acids, DNA and RNA, nucleotide. All right, so NAD dinucleotide, that means how many nucleotides are put together? Two. There's just two of them that are joined together. Flavin adenine dinucleotide, all right, that's another kind of coenzyme. More importantly, I want you to know what a coenzyme is. Can you remember what a coenzyme is? Is it a small metal ion, or is it a big organic molecule? Big organic molecule that does what? It carries something from one metabolic pathway to another metabolic pathway. And if it is going to be carrying electrons from one place to another, that is going to involve what? Oxidation-reduction reactions, right? Because that's the definition of an oxidation-reduction reaction, when an electron goes from one molecule to another. Yeah. Yeah, electrons. Let's just say electrons. You'll see where these protons are, but I think it's more handy to think of electrons. Even though conceptually I know this is not a chemistry class, you all have never seen an electron, but I think it's still easier to see it in terms of electrons. All right, and this is where some vitamins come from. Okay, they are coenzymes. All right, so what did I promise you? What is a coenzyme? A small metal ion or a big, complicated, organic molecule. So what do you see before your very eyes right here? Big, complicated, organic molecule. All right, so this is NAD. And you see there's one nucleotide here, and here is another nucleotide joined together. All right, how would you make this dinucleotide? How would you take two small nucleotides and put them together to make a dinucleotide? A dehydration synthesis reaction, right? Okay, and I'm not going to do that right here, but that would happen between these two phosphate groups. All right, so this is NAD, and NAD, okay, here's a nitrogen. Can you see there's a plus sign right there in your book? You can see it. Does it come out on the slide? That nitrogen has a little plus, and that means that it's going to accept what? Electrons. All right, so some electrons can be joined to the molecule, and it's going to change the shape a little bit. It adds a proton right here. But here are the two electrons that NAD plus can carry around inside the cell. See these two little electrons right here? And so NAD plus gets converted into what? NADH. And so NADH is the reduced form, and NAD plus is the oxidized form. So NAD can flip back and forth between an oxidized and a reduced form when it either gives up or gains electrons. The other molecule that's very important for carrying these electrons around inside the cell is FAD. Here is what FAD looks like, even a little bit more complicated. So these sites right here are the sites that can accept electrons. And here we have FAD in a oxidized state. When it accepts electrons, it becomes the reduced state. We call that FADH2, is the reduced state. All right, so what does FADH2 have, right, that it can carry around inside the cell? It's got a lot of energy in the form of what? These high energy electrons. The same thing for NADH. It has these high energy electrons that it can actually donate to a chemical reaction, and that's really the definition of a coenzyme. When it carries something from one part of the cell to another to give it up to have that reaction proceed. All right, so these are two important coenzymes that carry high energy electrons around inside the cell. And you know what? Those are not exam figures. Okay, you don't have to know how to draw these or recognize them, but you do have to know something about, you should know that NAD plus is what? Oxidized or reduced?
Oxidized.
It's oxidized. And NADH is reduced because it has accepted some electrons. And it's going to donate those electrons someplace later to produce energy. Okay. So we're done with the chapter on enzymes and thermodynamics. Okay. So NADH is the reduced. And NAD plus is the oxidized. All right, so I got a question for you. How do you go from, what has to happen in order for NAD plus to be converted into NADH? It's got to be reduced. Okay, it's got to accept those electrons, and they're high energy electrons. So now there's a lot more energy in NADH than there was in NAD plus. Okay. All right, so let me see what other slides I can show you for today. That must mean I think we got to go to what? Six?
Five.
Oh, we've already covered six. Okay, I'm glad we're getting started with this one today. All right, so this is cell respiration and metabolism. You probably covered a little bit of this already in lab. Okay, didn't you do cell respiration in lab? I think maybe you're doing a mouse experiment this week. You're doing a mouse experiment. And what is today? Wednesday? Oh, yeah, because Monday you're a week behind because of Memorial Day. Okay. Labor Day. All right, so here are some topics. These are the only three topics. This is really important that you don't spend too much time studying this chapter. All right, these are the three topics that I want you to know something about in this chapter, and not everything. All right, it's glycolysis, aerobic respiration, and a little bit about fat and protein metabolism. Just a little bit with these things right here. So don't spend a whole lot of time looking at the last pages of this chapter. All right. Well, we said something about energy. Energy is what? Some entity that's very nebulous, but it allows you to do what? Allows you to do work. Okay. All right. So let's define what metabolism is. In kind of the same way, let me get my pointer working again. Okay, what is metabolism? Metabolism is just the sum of all chemical reactions that are taking place in your body at one time. All right, so all the chemical reactions, all the oxidation reduction reactions, all the dehydration synthesis, all the hydrolysis reactions, if we add them all up together, that's metabolism, right? And there are a lot of reactions going on in your body, so you're highly metabolic. We can break all of metabolism down into two kinds, right? We talked about a number of different kinds, but the two basic kinds are catabolism and anabolism. Catabolism breaks down big molecules into smaller molecules, and in the process, that releases energy. Does that look like something right here? You take a big molecule, break it down into smaller molecules that, what? Releases energy. What kind of, in terms of thermodynamics, what do we call that? That's an exergonic reaction. All right, so catabolism is exergonic. Right? It's a primary source of energy for making ATP, because we saw how those gears are coupled together. All right, an anabolic reaction makes larger molecules, right, from smaller ones, and what does that require? Energy, right? And those are endergonic reactions. Okay, and that's the source of energy storage in the body. Okay, because we can store glucose, we can store energy in the form of lipids and things like that. All right, so when we talk about pretty much everything in this chapter, I want you to be able to relate it to this first slide right here. So let's spend a little time going over this first slide. All right, we've got a couple organ systems. All right, well, it's just a digestive system, but a couple parts of the digestive system. Here we see the alimentary canal, like the stomach and the small intestine. And when we eat something, right, we absorb glucose that's in our diet, and glucose goes into our circulatory system, into the blood. So this state right here is what we call the fed state, F-E-D, right? When you have material that you've just eaten and it's being digested down, and so glucose goes into the blood from food that you ate. So that's the fed state. What is the other state? When you're not eating anything. Like first thing in the morning when you wake up, all the food in your digestive tract is digested. And what are you're doing? You're not in the fed state, you're in the fasted state. So you're fasting as soon as you wake up. All right, but we all know that glucose concentration in the blood should be maintained within a very narrow range to maintain what? Homeostasis. All right, so when you're in a fasted state, there is an organ, namely the liver, that can break down glycogen, and glycogen is just made out of, what's a building block of glycogen? It is just glucose. So glycogen can be broken down, and that glucose then can be secreted into the blood, maintaining the proper level of blood glucose when you're in the fasted state. So when you're in a fed state, you get glucose from the food. When you're in a fasted state, you get glucose from your liver, right, when everything is working properly. Okay. All right, and then that glucose leaves the blood and it goes into various tissues, all the tissues in your body that need ATP, which is what? All your tissues need ATP, right? All living cells need ATP. So these cells take up glucose, and that glucose is now in the cytoplasm, right? And glucose is a large molecule. It's going to be broken down into pyruvic acid, which is a smaller molecule. So what is that? Is that an exergonic reaction or an endergonic reaction? A big one going into a small one, that's going to release energy. And guess what your cell knows how to do? What does your cell body know how to do with glycolysis when it goes, when this is a big exergonic reaction? It can use that energy to do what? Glycolysis produces a lot of energy that can be used to take ADP, inorganic phosphate, and convert it into ATP. All right, so we're going to see how that happens. How many carbon atoms are there in glucose? This is a really good, nice way to think of glycolysis. There are 6 of them, right, like this, and you can draw in all the H's and OH's. And what pyruvic acid is, and what glycolysis basically does, it breaks this bond right here, and you end up with what? 2, 3 carbon molecules. All right, so glycolysis takes glucose, snips it in half, and produces 2 pyruvic molecules. So if you want to put a 2 right here, that's fine with me. All right. And the other thing you might want to put on your slide is that glycolysis produces what? It produces energy, which then can be used to make ATP. All right. So glycolysis is, if it's producing energy, is what? Highly exergonic. Okay. Pyruvic acid. And pyruvic acid has another name. A lot of molecules have another name. Sometimes we call it pyruvate. So pyruvate and pyruvic acid are exactly the same molecule, no difference whatsoever. All right, this lightly shaded area right here, which is what, beige? Brown? I guess beige is brown, huh? Yellow? Okay, this is a very light yellow. Wow, it doesn't look yellow. Okay, what's this color here?
A darker yellow.
A darker yellow. Oh, wow, okay. Okay, I think I'm not the only one that's colorblind, but that looks yellow. Okay, yellow, light yellow, darker yellow. This light yellow right here represents the cytosol inside the cell. That's just the cytosol, right? The fluid part inside the cell. So where does glycolysis take place? You're going to say cytosol, right? Now, pyruvic acid can be converted into lactic acid. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. Or pyruvic acid can enter a mitochondria, right? And mitochondria is an organelle, right? So this organelle can take up pyruvic acid and via some other metabolic pathways, namely the Krebs cycle and electron transport, right? These are highly exergonic reactions as well that can be used to make ATP. Okay, and so where is the Krebs cycle located? It's in the mitochondria. And electron transport is in the mitochondria. So when we talk about these processes, I want you to be able to always relate to this first picture right here. All right, so what organelle in your cell produces CO2? Ah, it's on that slide right there. It's the mitochondria. And what do you breathe out of your body all the time? CO2. Where does it come from? It comes from mitochondria, right? They're producing CO2 because that's a highly exergonic reaction, and then mitochondria have figured out a way how to make just gobs of ATP, right, from pyruvic acid when it gets converted into CO2 and water. This is what we call aerobic respiration. So aerobic respiration happens in what organelle?
Mitochondria.
And what we don't see on the slide right here is that this last step requires oxygen. Okay? So you might want to say that oxygen has to get into the mitochondria in order for this to happen. If oxygen can't get into the mitochondria, none of this will happen and the mitochondria won't make ATP. So that's why we call this aerobic respiration. Glycolysis does not need oxygen. And this little side reaction of pyruvate being converted into lactic acid, all right, does not require oxygen, so we call it anaerobic respiration. So another way of thinking of this is that anaerobic respiration takes place where? Cytoplasm or cytosol or mitochondria? Cytosol. Anaerobic respiration happens in the cytosol. Aerobic respiration happens in the mitochondria. All right, so we got to fill in a little some details next time on these things. And the details we're going to look at are basically fourfold. One is glycolysis. The other is the preparation reaction. The third is the Krebs cycle. And the fourth is electron transport. A sign-in sheet?
No, SI.
SI today? I presume there is, but I haven't heard one way or the other. Yes, there is SI today, absolutely. All right, so we're going to start with glycolysis next time.
I want to ask, what are your optional?
Oh, check my syllabus, but I have some right now.
Yeah.
And then on Thursday. And then on Monday, I have some, too. Cool. I don't have any on Wednesday, though, because I go until about 6 o'clock. Yeah?